Thank you all for being here. I know that this is a Friday afternoon and people's attention may be waning a little bit, so we're going to do some things to get warmed up. But first, I wanted to talk about why there's a difference between the title of the session as printed in the program and the title that it is now, which is that I no longer believe that we can necessarily do things for good anymore. I think the best we can do is try to prevent harm. So today I want to, Emily and I want to tell you how we can organize in order to actually make sure that we can have ethical principles, that we cannot do harm as an industry. So first of all, we want to mention that we do have employers. However, these slides, this talk, is not the opinion necessarily of our employers. I am here in my personal capacity as a labor organizer. I am not here on behalf of my employer.
Yes, and a lot of this work has to do with the chapter that Liz and I wrote for Seeking SRE on the parallels of SRE and social justice activism. This is work that has been done over the past year and in my case, before I started at my current employer. So these are personal opinions and do not necessarily reflect official stances. And just by a bit of a note before we get started, there is a content warning for this talk. We're going to be discussing some very heavy things, and it's not going to be done gently. We're going to be talking about sexual harassment. We're going to be talking about discrimination, in specifically racial and disability discrimination. And we're going to get into some state-sponsored violence issues. And that includes both historical and current contexts of things like concentration camps, genocide, and we're also going to talk about hate speech and death threats with very graphic examples of those.
However, if you do feel that you need to step out, that's okay. You can come back in about 20 minutes because by then we'll have wrapped up that portion of the talk and we'll talk about your takeaways. So first, let's have you all close your eyes. I want people to feel safe raising their hands for this. How many of you have ever had a situation where you were asked to work on a project that you thought was ethically questionable? Raise your hand. Put your hands down. How many of you have ever been in a situation where you've observed someone else or yourself being discriminated against or harassed or otherwise unjustly treated in the workplace? Many more of you. Okay, we can all open our eyes now. By the way, that was about 5 or 10% on the first question and something like 30% on the second question. That's a lot of people. A lot of us run into these kinds of issues in our workplaces and yet we're not certain what to do about them, right? We're not certain what can we do to change our workplaces and to make sure that we're actually trying to create a fair and equitable environment. And that brings us to reasons that we might want to organize collectively as people who keep all of the software, all of the internet running. So there are a couple of different ways that we might try to improve our workplaces. For instance, we might try to improve our workplaces' working conditions, right? We might try to make our workplaces better places to work for ourselves or for our colleagues. Because how many of you have ever been in situations where you took like a pay cut to work somewhere, or you wound up dropping down a level, or you saw a colleague get down-leveled in the course of changing companies, right? Like that happens fairly often, where people aren't necessarily fairly paid for the work that they're doing. Or sometimes people get treated unjustly, right? Sometimes people wind up being threatened into saying, you know, oh, you have to do this favor for me or else I'm going to take punitive action against you in your performance review. Or how many of us have ever done unpaid on-call, right? That's a lot of us that have done unpaid on-call, right? That's not fair. That's not right, right? We should be paid for the work that we do. And then there are kind of the more typical things you hear about in the news, right? Like people who are propositioned by their bosses, people who are propositioned by their coworkers, people who receive sexual comments about their appearance at work. And you can imagine that it's really, really difficult for people to get their jobs done if they can't sit down and work because other people are threatening their ability to do work. And that's not right. So those are things that we can talk about. How do we make these things better? How can we organize our workplaces in order to make sure everyone has a fair shot at succeeding? But it's not just those kinds of issues, right? We can think about ourselves, but we can also think about the people that we serve by building our products. We can think about things like, do our products discriminate against minorities? And Theo's talk yesterday went into some detail on this, so I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail, right? But we design products that turns out that people with disabilities are unable to use because we've not designed them correctly. We have the soap dispensers that Theo talked about, where we make assumptions about who our users are and don't test thoroughly with the right set of people. And then there are also circumstances where people can wind up going to jail, right? Things that are crimes, things like Theranos, where they were defrauding people, where they are lying to people about their test results and costing people's lives. Or there are situations like La Liga. Go look up La Liga when you leave here. The Spanish Football League decided they're going to turn every phone running their app into a microphone to spy on bar owners to find out who had an illegal license to feed. And then there are a lot of examples that are actually both of these, and Emily will talk about them in a few minutes. But what I also want you to think about is, what's the overall ecosystem of what we're building? What are the results when we build things that, for instance, disemploy people and uproot people from jobs with benefits, and instead create fractured situations where people are working for an algorithm and not receiving benefits and have no control over the work that they're doing? Think about the gig economy. Think about Airbnb, right? And think about all the people that are service workers who are not treated the same way that we are as engineers in our workplaces. Think about the people that don't receive parental leave, or think about the people that don't receive fair pay or safe working conditions who are working in our cafeterias. And think about the impact that we have in our communities when we outspend on rent and drive people, outprice people out of our communities who were living there before. And think about the situations where our employers lobby for legislation or freedom from legislation that is in opposition to our interests as workers. Think about situations where our employers argue that people should have less privacy in the European Union, for instance. There are many examples of this where the intersection of all of the work that we do winds up going to benefit people who have interests very different than ours. And it winds up being the case that there are also cases where our projects and our working conditions intersect. For instance, imagine that you are someone who is Muslim, who is asked to build an application to track Muslim people in your country, to identify them for deportation. Do you think that that would be a safe working condition for you at work? I argue that would be perpetuating religious discrimination against you in your own workplace, as well as upon the rest of the world. Or what about those of us that work for social media companies, where we have to engage with the public to some extent as a facet of our jobs, and yet our companies don't provide us with the tools to safely protect ourselves, to be free of harassment? These are situations where those two things come together, and we are both customers and a worldwide user base, and also people building these products. And we should have a say in how these things are built.
And these are important questions because the honest truth is that our industry is in a state of deep ethical crisis right now. And this is not an ethics talk, despite having ethics in the title. This is a talk about action. And one of the things that we need to realize is that all of the discussions that we have been having over the past couple of years about things like ethical codes in computing or biases in machine learning are insufficient, too little, and too late. And so I'm done talking about those things, and I'm done trying to bring case studies into the discussion, because we need to catch up, and we need to catch up quickly. The ethics crisis that we are facing is not a trolley problem. It is not an intellectual exercise. In fact, the trolley problem wasn't even a problem for trolleys, so let's just throw that out. These distal, abstract, interesting academic issues are not the problem. The problem is we are using technology directly for things that are evil. And I will give you some examples. In the United States, the news this summer has been that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division of the Department of Homeland Security has been stripping children from their parents and putting them in cages. So far, two of these children under 2 years old have died. They are traumatized. They've been separated from their parents. And in this whole process, it's come out that ICE has been using a piece of software over the past several years to recommend whether or not somebody should be detained or released under supervision. This piece of software, some time ago, was changed so that it would always recommend detain. So we can talk about all of the machine learning biases and data biases and all of the cultural issues and technology, all that we want. But when our classifier is if true, return detain, we have a bigger problem. We have a problem that our software, our industry, is being used to uphold a version of white supremacy. And this is not just happening in the United States. This is a global problem. 2 weeks ago, in Berlin, to celebrate the anniversary of the death of Rudolf Hess, Adolf Hitler's aide, hundreds of Nazis marched in Berlin, and they had a banner that contained a Rudolf Hess quote saying, "I regret nothing." This is Berlin. This week, a story came out that said that there is a statistically significant link between Facebook usage with certain groups and pages and anti-refugee violence in certain towns in Germany. Statistically significant. If you move one standard deviation up from the typical usage patterns on these groups, there's a 50% increase in violence against refugees. And a few days ago, 1,000 far-right anti-immigrant activists, white supremacists, were hunting people of color and immigrants in the streets of Chemnitz. And last night, 10,000 people marched in Berlin and Chemnitz to oppose that. So this is happening, and it's happening right now, and they are using our platforms that we are building and turning a blind eye to how they are being used. This is a state of crisis. This is not an abstract academic problem. Your ethics here are relevant. And we're here to talk to you because we want you to put your ethics into action. It is not acceptable to have workplaces where your coworkers are discriminated against because of who they are. It is not acceptable to discriminate against your users. It is not acceptable to use technology to enforce societal norms on people based on who they are. We can't treat our communities with discrimination and violence. White supremacy is not okay, and to fight it, we need you to be engaged. And so that is what we're here to talk about, how we can change the technology industry together to solve this problem through direct action. So how do we do that? How do we fix this?
Well, I've had a few successes. I wish I had more successes, but this is my track record. I have spent 15 years as a tech worker, including 2 years as a manager. I'm not a manager anymore. And I am also a queer transgender woman of color. And that's influenced me a lot in terms of the level of discrimination that I've experienced and what I can see and the harms that I can see being done. And I've also been a labor organizer and an activist inside of my employer for the past 8 years. But today I'm speaking up and trying to encourage everyone to act rather than just working within my own company. And yes, there have been a few media articles, but I perceive that as a failure rather than a success when it gets to that point of getting so out of control that it winds up in the media.
And my story is not too dissimilar. I've been in tech for a while, give or take 15 years. And I am a lead data scientist, but I'm not here speaking as a data scientist. I'm here speaking as an anti-fascist activist and an anti-racist activist. And if I'm angry with my tone, it's because I'm standing here before you, and my success is that I'm still breathing. Because in the past year, I have survived mob violence, multiple assaults, one terrorist incident, and at least one case that legitimately can be considered to be a targeted attempt of murder. My work has been, if you're in the United States, you've probably seen me on TV. There's been several documentaries covering my work in exposing white supremacists in the United States Marine Corps. I've appeared in the Washington Post, New York Times, ProPublica, but the proudest thing that I have done is have an article published in Teen Vogue. It's the best publication out there.
So for this next couple of slides, we're going to have the recording turned off. We've spent a lot of time over the past few days talking about how do we run an incident, right? This is something that we know how to do now, if we didn't know before. Right? We think about how do we structure large-scale actions in order to make sure that each individual person knows exactly what they're supposed to do, and that everything works together and comes together nicely. We also know things like, how do we learn from events? How do we conduct blameless postmortems? How do we make sure that we ask the right questions, thinking about contributing factors rather than root causes, and asking and having empathy for each other, what was going on in Emily's head or my head, how did we come to the conclusions that we did, and how can we do better next time? And it turns out that these things have a lot of parallels.
One of the things that I learned over the past year or so in doing activism, in working in technology, is that there's a deep set of best practices, or deep connection between the set of best practices that we use in social activism movements and that we've developed in technology. And this is not the only such set of principles, but I find it very useful because it's very easy to draw parallels between the St. Paul principles, which were developed 10 years ago in response to a protest action, and what we do in the tech industry. Things like respect for diversity of tactics can be thought of as differentiation of roles. Thinking of creative problem solving, allowing people to do their best work in the way that they find it to be appropriate rather than following a cookie cutter pattern. Maintaining a separation of time or space in actions or tactics. That can be, you know, a typical troubleshooting exercise where, you know, you don't start thinking about how to change your, you know, database when you're in the middle of an outage. You need to fix the outage. And of course, the third point is really important, to avoid airing your dirty laundry in public, right? The first thing that you should do is always work with your team, work with your company, work with your organization to solve these issues before bringing them public. But that does not mean that bringing them public is always out of the question. What it means is that we should seek to resolve conflicts internally before seeking external input, and that we should develop the skills to resolve those conflicts internally as a core part of how we do our everyday jobs. And this fourth point I used to think was going to be the hardest sell for the tech industry, but not anymore. I think that the fourth point is the most important, and that is that we oppose state surveillance, we oppose infiltration and disruption by law enforcement, and we do not assist law enforcement against activists. And I think that's super important because what we've seen in the United States is that law enforcement is going to tech companies and they're trying to subpoena records and they're trying to get search warrants for things like access logs, user databases, the software used to host websites. And on January 20th of 2017, over 200 activists were arrested for a free speech event in Washington, D.C., protesting Donald Trump's inauguration. Those activists were assaulted with pepper spray, tear gas, shot with rubber bullets, mass arrested. Some of them were sexually assaulted in jail. And then they were charged with multiple felonies, and they each faced over 80 years in prison for free speech. One of those activists wasn't even at the protest. They raided his house later and arrested him because he ran the website used to advertise the protest. And they charged him with inciting a riot simply because he ran a website. And if it can happen to him, it can happen to you as the operator of the website. And when they tried to get, when they tried to search his web host, they said they submitted a search warrant that looked for all stored electronic communications, digital files, records, messages, IP logs, photographs, and all software used to host a website. As SREs, we can actively and passively resist this type of law enforcement overreach. We can do it by simply not keeping those logs longer than we need to. We can do it by creatively interpreting those requests. They want all the software used to serve the website. There's nothing preventing you from printing out the assembly, you know, the compiled assembly code for something like Redis and sending it to them for every architecture, for every CPU that you run in your data center.
So when we talk about doing these kinds of acts of collective resistance, we need to think about what's our strategy? What makes us feel that we can safely accomplish this if we act together? And what protections do we have? Because I know that that's really important, that people don't want to step out on a limb without knowing that someone's going to catch them if they fall. And I think the best tool that we have is that our companies say in their mottos, don't be evil, or connecting and empowering people. And we can say, hey, does this actually advance the company's mission or not? Is this a representation of what the company stands for, what we signed up for when we joined this company? Does your company say that it wants people to speak up to a compliance hotline or to management if they see something that's wrong? Call your company on this promise. Hold them accountable. Yes, your company in the industry ethics codes are too little and too late in that not enough people have subscribed to them. But when you're trying to justify your actions, you can still say, I'm a member of the ACM or IEEE. I cannot support this because that would cause me to be in violation of the code that I signed. And I think one of the most important things is that we can collectively act in solidarity because we as engineers are valuable, both in terms of monetary value and knowledge. It costs a company 6 months to a year of productivity every time they have to replace one engineer from a team, costing hundreds of thousands of euro. But what if your entire team responsible for maintaining your privacy and GDPR compliance infrastructure were to quit or go on strike? Or what would happen if every SRE in this room, especially those of us that are based in Europe, all quit or went on strike at the same time and no one was supporting the site over European hours and no one was doing the reliability work necessary to keep it running in the long term? Our collective action and solidarity does matter because if we leave one by one, our companies will replace us, but they can't replace all of us at once if enough of us say, we won't stand for this. Your local labor laws may be helpful. I'm not from the European Union, but my understanding is that there are labor unions in the European Union who have a history of forming works councils and working with employers on people's working conditions. And that in the case of transnational employers, like many of us do work for companies with offices in London and Dublin and Zurich, where you can form a works council in order to band together with workers from other offices employed by the same employer. Whistleblowing is something that people have done in the past and will do in the future, but it has some risks. Because whistleblower protections are weak, they typically relate only to violations of law. And not everything that we're talking about here is a violation of law. For example, concentration camps were not a violation of national law in the countries where they were instituted. There is a law proposing whistleblower protections pending before the EU. That is a useful thing to write to your legislators about. But I think the most important reason why it's important to be careful with whistleblowing is to think about collateral impacts. Are you acting in solidarity with other people? Is this advancing the cause, or is it going to set your efforts behind and clamp down on people's future ability to find out things that are problems in the company? But if you do choose to whistleblow, be already at the point that you're prepared to resign or lose your job or potentially even go to jail.
And it's important to be prepared for the worst if that's what it comes to. This should be the action of last resort, obviously. Because the circumstances and the consequences for this can be great. But we can lessen the impact based on how we act as teams, as cultures, as societies, by acting in solidarity. We need to remember that remedies are a retrospective action, but we can prepare for things in the future. Question is, not what would you do if you had to blow the whistle, but what would you do if your teammate had to blow the whistle? What would you do if your teammate got arrested at a protest? Would you be there to feed their cats? Who's gonna cook dinner for their kids? Who's gonna take them to baseball practice? We can come up with backup plans, and the best backup plans are to create solidarity amongst each other, to create collective action where we can support each other, and to look for solutions together. We need to start building those strategies rather than just looking at what the problems are, because if we work together, we can affect this change. And for people who are not necessarily workers in the working class, but who are executives and managers, you also have some work to do too. Because you need to ask yourself, is your company ready to handle an escalation when ethics go poorly? What if it's with a client? What if it's with a supplier? What if it's with a human resources crisis? Are you ready to handle these issues and to do the right thing? Not the thing that is popular, not the thing that is going to save you the PR backlash, but are you ready to do the right thing? And we need to talk about this because this change is worth the cost, even when the cost is great. I have seen the cost with my own eyes of what it takes to stand up to terror and violence. And this cost is borne by less of us when more of us act. And the cost that we bear will be lesser when we have more people there to support us. So we're asking for your help. We can organize and we can make it successful.
So when you do have a concern, what should you do about it? How do we make sure that we have the ability to influence decisions at the right point in time and do so effectively and change the outcome? The most important thing, as we've been talking about this week, is the idea that it's easier to remove risk when you engage early, that it's easier to change the design when you're aware of it early and you can influence it. So we have to think about how can we develop these fast feedback loops, not just around product in terms of reliability, but also in terms of ethics. How can we catch issues early? And a lot of that revolves around knowing what's going on inside of your workplace and not just turtling within your own work group and focusing only on your own product. Listen to your colleagues, listen to your customers. Diverse networks really do matter. Speaking of diverse networks and solidarity, it's really, really important to use all available mechanisms to communicate with other people, not just talking to the people that you see in the office every day. Many of us work with teams in other offices. Use IRC. Talk to them about things that they're worried about. And make sure that you're building that trust, that you're actively listening and empathizing. And I mean really listening, not just the surface conversations. And when someone does come to you and say, Liz or Emily, I'm worried. I'm feeling scared by something I've just seen. I'm feeling afraid. Listen to them. And listen not just to the emotional content alone or the rational content, but listen to both so you can better advocate for them in the future as to what are they afraid of and what would they like changed. And it tends to shut down a conversation if you start telling someone immediately, why don't we come up with some answers to that? Because some of these people are just looking for someone to listen to their problems. There's a cool comic, go scan that QR code at some point. Right, but the important thing is that doing effective advocacy is very different from venting. That someone who is venting is not in a good place to necessarily change the decision that someone's making, whereas someone who is able to persuasively argue it, who is separated by a little bit of distance, can be a little bit more effective. And always remember, have these emotional conversations not on your corporate laptop, not on IRC. Have them in a medium that is not going to be recorded and sent to the New York Times or sent to a, or that you would get sued over. So once you've identified a problem like this, you have to find the right decision maker, right? You have to not yell at the team that's trying to implement this thing. Chances are they're as upset by it as you, and they're looking for help from you rather than you yelling at them. So find who the real decision maker is and make sure that you have the right context who will tell you who the decision maker is and perhaps even help you argue with that decision maker. And it's usually a good start to assume good faith, although you can't continue assuming it forever. Often executives are trying to do something that's in accordance with the company's mission, and they're just not aware of what the implications are, or they have different assumptions. So you can help talk through and say, here are my arguments. Here's a different way of doing things that still helps the company accomplish a goal, but avoids this giant ethical morass. Also, don't come to an executive with 100 people with pitchforks and torches at their door. Right, send 3 or 4 people to act as a smaller delegation so they don't feel overwhelmed and mobbed. And be trustworthy. If someone wants to negotiate with you, negotiate with them. Don't leak every detail of your negotiations in the middle of the negotiation. But sometimes these steps don't always work. And in that case, you do have to escalate, because it's better to escalate than be complicit. So employee petitions can work, have worked in the past, and it requires a minimum of about 5% of your employer's engineers to stand up and say, we're not okay doing this, that we are potentially willing to quit if you press on with this project. In order to get to 5%, you need to be clear and short, because you're going to need to persuade a large number of people to sign on to this. three sentences, one demand. That's all you get to argue. That's all someone's attention span is. Again, QR code if you want to read more about that. Media engagement. It's a thing that can be useful, but it also generates a lot of resistance in return. People will accuse you of leaking. Sometimes that's even true, right? And it can cause executives to say, you know what, I'm going to dig my heels in because I don't want to have to walk that defense back. But it can be situationally powerful. The public eye is a very good disinfectant. And you can also complain to regulators. And you can also strike or quit. You can vote with your feet if you need to.
But most of all, this is shift work. And you've got to put your own oxygen mask on first. Or gas mask. You know, sometimes the tear gas comes out. But you need to avoid burnout. And this is something that really hits home for me personally, because I've had to leave my country, had to leave my family, left a pretty good job back in the United States, and I've moved to Berlin because I knew that I would not survive if I didn't pull myself out of that situation and take a step back. And so in order to keep up this fight, we need to engage and recognize the limitations in ourselves and in our peers and make sure that we're doing this for the long run. This ethical crisis that we're in has been a generation to a generation and a half in the making. And it's not going to be fixed overnight. This is going to take years to get ourselves out of. So if we're going to solve it, we have to be ready for the long run. So we need to do that with that in mind. This fight will take a long time. In order to do that, we want to create virtuous cycles of ethics. We want to create virtuous cycles of action and of progress. We need to understand that as professionals, ethics is a core part of our job. It's part of our job description. All of that paperwork that you sign when you join a new employer, you know, you just kind of like gloss over it and you put your signature on it or whatever, those things are actually important on a day-to-day basis, and you should treat them as relevantly as you treat a new framework, a new tool, a new service. Ethics crises, when they arise, they are a failure of process. Back up one. They're a failure of process. So if we don't treat our everyday with ethics, then we find ourselves in a morass. And so we need to look at ethics as a continuous process. Just like we talk about continuous integration, continuous deployment, we need continuous ethics. Crises are nothing more than a scarcity of time and attention. They're not a deficit of skill. When we're in a state of crisis, it's because we don't have enough time or resources to solve every problem. And so we need to act in a state of triage. So right now, we are here to triage this industry. We need action, we need decision making, and part of that is that we need to recognize that we are not going to reinvent 400 years of Enlightenment thought around things like the concept of free speech. That's not a problem for us to solve. The problem for us to solve is that there are literally people dying on the streets, and we can do something about that right now.
So really quickly, it's important to not throw ourselves in every single fire, be strategic rather than tactical, because each crisis individually is toil, but together if we develop the right frameworks, we can fix this. We need scalable solutions. It's important to think about early detection, about making our systems do the right thing by default, and by when it needs to happen, doing crisis management.
And to wrap this up quickly, there's no Band-Aid solutions. The ethics codes are the foundation of the solution. They are not the solution in themselves. Remember that following the law is not the same thing as being moral. And that following a code of ethics is not the same thing as being ethical. You can game the law just like you can game a code of ethics. And we also need to look beyond Silicon Valley, okay? Because solving our industry is not the only thing that's going to fix this. It's not the only battle that we have to fight. That software I talked about that was recommending detain for every case was not built by Google. It was not built by Amazon. It was built by a company with $24 billion of revenue and 150,000 employees worldwide. And they contract to the government to build this type of stuff. And this is not a company that is going to have representatives at SREcon and tech conferences around the world. So we need to understand the limits of our abilities, start within our own house, and work out from there.
So we can, in fact, solve this if we're proactive, if we prevent crises, and we pick our fights carefully. We've left some resources for you, which we'll post the notes online afterwards. But the main thing that we wanted to encourage you to do is please do something, because Emily and I cannot solve this problem by ourselves. Please commit to acting in accordance with your ethics. Thank you.